Muy bien, aquí va entrando gente. Vamos a empezar. Bienvenidos a esta segunda parte de Internet del Dinero. Vamos a, cómo va a ir hoy, sabéis que tenemos un invitado muy especial. Vamos a hacer los primeros 30 minutos, 30, 40 minutos con Andreas. Vamos a hacer unas preguntas, vamos a abrir micro. Y luego vamos a seguir con Julián, que también está aquí hoy con nosotros. En español, y al final de la sesión se nos va a unir otro invitado sorpresa. Así que empezamos y vamos a dar la bienvenida a nuestro invitado. So, welcome to the second part of the second edition of Prometheus Book Club. This February, we have been discussing Internet of Money, volumes 1 and 2. And today we have a very special guest with us, and it's none other than the author of the book himself, Andreas Antonopoulos. Andreas, good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you so much, Entropy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for us. Thank you very much for joining us today. It makes us very happy. First thing first, congratulations for the recent published third edition of Mastering Bitcoin.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes. Although the congratulations should probably go more to David Harding, my co-author, who did all the work for this edition. But yes, thank you.
Yeah, kudos for David too. That's so much value. Thank you. Thank you so much. So, Andreas, I thought if I should do an introduction, but I think that maybe 99% of the audience here knows you and your work a lot. So I think that unless you have something you would like to share with us in the beginning, I will skip the formal introductions and get straight to the questions.
Sure thing. That's fine with me.
Perfect. Before that, I would like to introduce you the second guest who joined us for the first part for 2 weeks. He's Julian Drangos. Julian, good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you for inviting me, Entropy, and thank you for Andreas for joining us.
Julian is you know Andreas work very well. You told us the last session a little anecdote about how you got your first copy of Internet of Money. Would you share that with us again?
Yes, for sure. We've met with Andreas a few times. I don't know if he will remember me, but we
Yes, I
met
do.
here at LaBitConf editions 2018 and 2019, Chilean and Uruguayan editions. And after that, Andreas came to Buenos Aires a few days in January of 2019, I think so. And he gave a talk about crypto winter and crypto summer. He sold out an entire theater in 3 days, maybe here in Argentina, because, well, we are really thirsty for this kind of knowledge and this kind of activities. And I asked a question in one of his talks, and he very generously signed a copy of Internet of Money in the, you were giving away the first Spanish copies, I think so. And you signed one of them.
Yes, I do remember, and it's unfortunately I haven't been back to Argentina since before the pandemic, but I hope to be back again soon. I think I've now been to Argentina maybe 7 or 8 times. I love it there, and I hope to visit again.
For sure, we will be waiting you with our arms wide open. And without further ado, if you want, let's start. I have prepared a few questions regarding the Internet of Money Volume 2, and then we will open up the mic for other participants to ask their own questions. So you have a great talk about the evolutionary nature of Bitcoin, open blockchains, and cryptocurrencies. And you mentioned that they are constantly evolving, you know, the Are you still following the development of Bitcoin closely, or
yes, or I am.
Are you distance yourself from that? Perfect. And several of the old gang of Bitcoin developers have or retired or distanced themselves from the development. How do you see the new cohort compared to the previous one? And is there a new development in which you are interested in the most? I mentioned a few examples, maybe BitVM, Object Template Verify, OpCat, or maybe the new Discover DLCVM that it was published yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I keep following these, and for those of you who are more technical, a great resource to follow these, I think, is the Bitcoin OpTech newsletter. It's my favorite place to get kind of news about developments summarized and focused. The developer mailing lists are very busy, but the OpTech does a great job of summarizing the latest things. I'm still very interested in more the development of primitives, especially things like Check Template Verify and OpCat. Really, there's two or three opcodes that are all intended to open up a pretty broad range of use cases, and they all kind of have overlap in their function. So CTV and CAT, they both aim to fulfill the same purpose. The most interesting applications of those are in doing things like vaults or covenants, where you can lock Bitcoin with various long-term rules that control the spending in the next transaction. And also very interesting to me is that they enable much simpler implementation for the Lightning Network, specifically a type of protocol called L2, ELTOO, which makes the Lightning Network less complicated, more efficient, and more safe for use. So I'm watching those quite carefully. So the BitVM and the DLCVM, to tell you the truth, I find those developments far less interesting. I'm of the opinion that attempting to do smart contracts in Bitcoin is a road that has been traveled many times and has failed many times. And the fundamentals do not support it. The market does not support it. So finding new and more complicated ways to do it doesn't really appeal to me. But hey, you know, try anything you want.
Great. Yes, they are open systems in nature, and everyone can develop whatever they can think of. And then it's up to the markets to decide if they are good implementations and if they want to use them.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned unintended consequences in technologies through the book In the Technological Evolution. We have seen unintended consequences of the taproot soft fork, giving birth to Ordinal, BRC20 tokens, inscriptions, and NFTs on Bitcoin. Do you have an opinion on them, other than it's an open system and we can all do what the protocol tells us, lets us do? Do you see this new case competing or pushing the monetary transactions out of the chain? And if maybe this type of use is going to cause a post-stress traumatic disorder of doing a new soft fork, maybe? Because we've seen it with the block size wars that created stress for Taproot, and this may be a next one.
Yeah, I disagree with the assessment that it was Taproot specifically that allowed ordinals. I think ordinals and BRC20 tokens and NFTs were possible before and have been done before. Since the very beginning, since 2012, people have been trying to do various layered token solutions in Bitcoin. And the truth of the matter, the simple truth is this. In information systems, all information is simply bits. And so if you decide that you want to put bits that represent a JPEG or represent a URL or something else into Bitcoin, there's 100 different ways you can do it. And there's honestly no way to stop people from doing that. If you didn't give them a space to put it in the signature, they'd put it in the keys, they'd put it in the outputs, they'd put it in a multi-sig with fake public keys that are actually JPEGs. If you have space where you can put binary information, then you can't ensure that that binary information is what you think it is. You can think it's a key, a public key, for example, or an address, and then someone can put in that same space something that is a JPEG, because bits are bits. And this is actually something that gives us a lot of freedom on the internet, because it's because all bits are the same that we can do things like VPNs, we can hide traffic inside SSL, that we can hide information inside images, that we can effectively have freedom to communicate. So it's not Taproot that created this. Taproot simply enabled... And in fact, it was actually Segregated Witness that opened the door for ordinals, not Taproot. But it's basically these technologies gave us more space in the blockchain to put data. And then whether that data is transactions or stupid JPEGs, or as they're called, shitpegs, is really not something you can make a choice. So there's two reasons why I don't think this is a big problem. The first is I think that Bitcoin is a very inefficient and flexible system for doing smart contracts and NFTs. It's too expensive. It has enormous censorship resistance and robustness and security, which is completely unnecessary for most NFT and token uses. And so as a result, why would you be using the very expensive, very robust system to do something that doesn't need that level of expense and robustness? It's a bit like taking an M1 Abrams tank to the supermarket in order to pick up your shopping. Now, there is the possibility that you might come under sustained fire on your way to the supermarket. But it's unlikely. And so what you're doing is you're just wasting a lot of gas and taking up a lot of road space for something that is unnecessary. So I think that ordinals and inscriptions and all of these other token things will not find market success. The market has said clearly that the right platform for doing these things is Ethereum and will continue to be Ethereum. And so it's a waste of time to try those, but that's good news because that means they're not going to clog up the block space for too much longer. But there's a broader philosophical question, which is how do you prevent these things from going into the blockchain? And the simple answer is you don't prevent them, because if you make space, data space available on the blockchain for transactions, the only way you can prevent people from putting junk in there is by having a cost associated. And if people are willing to pay the fee to put junk in there, then they paid the fee and the junk gets in there. There are only two ways to allocate space in a blockchain. One is a marketplace of fees with an auction, which is what we do now. And the other one is a dictatorship of developers or node operators that decide what is a legitimate application and what is not. I would much rather have a marketplace decide that, because the problem is if you make developers gatekeepers, then all kinds of consequences come out of that. And in fact, I don't think they'd actually be able to stop the junk anyway. It would just get disguised as something else. So I'm not worried about this. I don't think this is a problem. And I don't think it's an unintended consequence of Taproot. It's a simple reality of information systems that all data can be put and made to look like all other data.
Thank you for your answer and your clarification regarding the consequence. So since we are talking about NFTs and another uses of open blockchains, you gave a talk that it's great. It's called Bitcoin versus Ethereum, the lion and the shark. It's a great comparison between Bitcoin and Ethereum, that it's a metaphor about which one is better, a fight that it will not be solved because each one is their own apex predator in their own medium. Yeah, it's a great one. And since we've seen several Cambrian explosions of innovation, the first one with what it was called altcoins, then now virtual machine blockchains, do you see maybe a third space for something else to grow? Or is everything covered under the paradigm security and robustness versus expressivity and smart contracts?
Oh, no, I think the space is much broader than that. And in fact, I think that the more we explore the market and we develop, hang on one second, because my laptop just told me I'm running out of battery. Very good timing. One second. All right, I'm back. Much better. Sorry for that. I just discovered my plug wasn't plugged in, and that helps. All right. I think the space is much broader than just two use cases. I think we've explored two very big use cases, but I don't think that's the end. I think that there are other environments and niche applications that open up. And the more we explore and the more research and innovation that is done in this space, the more we're going to find areas where perhaps the existing apex predators, as I put it, do not cover well. And so, you know, who knows? Maybe the next talk is going to be the lion, the shark, and the eagle. The lion, the shark, the eagle, and the cobra. I don't know, but essentially, the idea that I was trying to put is that we have to think of the market space as a series of, almost like a series of different ecologies, different niches. And the fact is that as a system becomes a bit specialized so that it fits very cleanly into one of these ecologies and ends up dominating that ecology, that doesn't make it perfect for every ecology. And there will be other equally well-fit systems that fit in other ecologies, and they don't compete directly. The argument I was making with the lion and the shark wasn't, you know, the particular characteristics of lions or sharks. It was more the general idea that if you wanted to find out who's stronger, a lion or a shark, you can't actually put them in a fight. Because if the fight is in water, the shark wins. And if the fight is on land, the lion wins. And so it doesn't depend on whether one of them is stronger. It depends purely on what problem you're trying to solve or what environment you're trying to fit in. I would say that of those two niches that you described, kind of expressive, rich, expressive, flexible versus robust, uncensorable, monetary, the third one, which is emerging, is strong privacy. I think we're beginning to see more of a fight develop around privacy coins. And I think that's a niche that, unfortunately, neither Ethereum nor Bitcoin serve very well. And as a result, you need a specialized system to solve those. If I have one regret about the development of Bitcoin is that privacy wasn't taken more seriously at the base layer in the early days when it could have been done before too many institutional investors. At this point, I don't think it can be done anymore. So that opens up a niche that Bitcoin cannot occupy, a niche that Ethereum cannot occupy unless it changes significantly. And I think that's at least one third niche that we haven't yet explored, but there's more. I'm sure there's more than that.
Yes, for sure. We will see it. There has been a lot of investigation regarding privacy. I recall Mimblewimble being implemented, I think, last year on Litecoin via expansion blocks. So for sure, we will see. And for my last question, and then we will open up the mic for all participants and Entropy. In your talk, Bitcoin and Fake Money, it's discussed how Bitcoin can be an alternative to fake money. And in another one of your talks, you created a metaphor about how countries are like airplanes, all behaving the same way, nose diving into the ground, but with different altitudes and angles. Do you see them changing anytime soon, this plan? Is Bitcoin or something similar the only solution or our escape from the old system? How does Bitcoin provide a solution to the erosion of trust in national currencies?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. I mean, I think that things are going to change, but they're not going to change for the better. In fact, if anything, what we're seeing is things are changing for the worse. So the global pandemic provided a pretty significant shock to the global economy, and that has led a lot of countries to go into recession and to try to stimulate their way out of that. And because it's always easier to stimulate than it is to tax, tax the rich, the result is that in many countries, there's a ton of debt that's being created, and massive economic inequality as a result. So, I was reading recently, the US dollar is now, the US economy is now producing $1 trillion of new debt every 100 days. So that's $3 trillion a year at the current rate. And it's accelerating because the interest payments are going up.
Yes. So, Argentina, we are living the same thing since forever.
Exactly. And I don't think that's going to change in Argentina either, despite some recent proclamations of change. So I see these problems, these are not easy problems to solve. They're difficult, multi-layered socioeconomic problems that don't have easy solutions. The easy solutions, if you hear them, you should be very concerned, because the kind of person who gives you an easy solution to a difficult problem is a populist, and usually they're robbing you while they're telling you about this solution. So I think the national currencies are going to get worse. Now, is Bitcoin the only solution? No, absolutely not. It isn't the only solution, and I don't think people should treat it as the only solution. I think it is one of several solutions, and it might be better in some ways and worse in other ways for different people in different circumstances. I would say, for example, gold has always been a good solution for long-term savings, but so have other forms of investments. Many people have been very successful with protecting their savings by investing in real estate, by investing in businesses, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't believe you put all of your eggs in one basket, or you look for one solution to fix everything. I just think that Bitcoin is a very powerful new tool that we have that has certain unique characteristics that make it very flexible, very difficult to stop or suppress or prevent people from accessing it. Those are unique characteristics of Bitcoin that make it perfectly suited to help people, especially in environments where they're trying to prevent you from helping yourself. So, and I think we're going to need more and more solutions like that. So yeah, not much has changed since then. The only difference is all of the aircraft in the air are now at a lower altitude, and the angles are you know, more steep than they used to be.
Andreas, thank you for your time, for your dedication, and all your courses that you do at University of Nicosia also. I've taken them all. And I will open up the mic to everyone who wants to ask you a question. And entropy also.
Yes, thank you, Julian. I will read some of the questions that the members of the group left in the group in this whole week. And then if we have a little bit of time, we will open the mic. I will, this one long question and then like four or five short ones. So I will start with Apix. He asks, in the Bitcoin scalability debate, it is absolutely clear that Bitcoin itself, as designed, is not scalable. Scalability solutions usually come in the form of second and third layers or side chains. Personally, he says, I like Eric Voskuhl's approaches a lot because they are very different. In recent days, Eric has made the argument that the Bitcoin white paper is nothing more than a definition of what Bitcoin should be. And Bitcoin, what we all know as Bitcoin, is just an implementation of what is defined in the white paper. But it doesn't have to be just one Bitcoin. As demand for block space grows, fees and probably the price will rise. But one solution, according to Eric, would be to have multiple implementations of Bitcoin, like BTC0, BTC1, BTC2. I have my reservations about that, and it's a very controversial point of view. But it's something that, on reflection, I don't think is too far-fetched in the future. How do you see it, Andreas?
Well, thanks for that question. You know, I would say that obviously Eric Voskuhl is very intelligent and has provided a lot of great commentary and a lot of great ideas in the space. And I certainly do pay attention when he talks about these things. I'm not sure about this particular proposal, and I think it would be very difficult to implement because there has been such cultural resistance to altcoins that anything you try to create to increase scalability that you name BTC1, BTC2, BTC3 will immediately get labeled an altcoin, whether it is or not. There are some significant concerns about how you transfer liquidity between the two of them, which would require things like drive chains, side chains, power chains, bridges, swaps, something to maintain liquidity or maintain a price peg between multiple chains. It's an interesting proposal. I find it fascinating that in this entire scalability proposal, the issue very quickly became a political issue about power rather than a technical consideration of how to improve scaling. You know, very, very quickly in the beginning of this debate in 2016, it became obvious that while there were several good choices, the debate became about who should make that choice and who has the power or the authority to make that choice. And as a result, the debate got derailed from the choices and became more about who should be making that choice, and a lot of people fighting about that question, the question of power rather than the question of the best scalability solution. In the end, it wasn't even a technical decision about what we should do first. Because if you look at the technical fundamentals, SegWit as a solution was not instead of a block size increase, it was before a block size increase, with the assumption that we can do a block size increase later. And actually I'm in favor of that. So I believe that we need to do many things to scale Bitcoin. And it's not going to be one solution one time. It's going to be many, many, many small changes over time that gradually scale Bitcoin again and again and again to meet increased demand. And I don't count. I don't count against a block size increase. We can do that too. In fact, a block size increase, a modest, reasonable block size increase to reflect the changes in bandwidth and storage costs that people have that won't cause centralization of node ownership or a huge burden on node owners. I think a modest block size increase is still on the table for me. And especially now that we have layer two solutions, a modest block size increase actually has a magnifying effect because, you know, the Lightning Network can then multiply that small block increase and produce a lot more channel open close. So it's going to take multiple things to fix the scalability solution, to fix scalability in Bitcoin. It's not one thing and it's not one and done. And I think trying to find the perfect solution that everyone can agree on is counterproductive. I think we're gonna have to be a bit more willing to compromise in some ways without affecting the decentralization and security of the network. So what do we really care about? We care that there are no more than 21 million Bitcoin. We care that the network remains decentralized and can resist censorship. There are some fundamental principles that we all agree on. And I think there's a lot of room to find sensible technical solutions as long as we don't turn this into a fight about who should be making the choice. So I'm not arguing for any of those solutions anymore. but I'm always interested in reading about them.
Okay, perfect. Thanks. You said in your answer that a block increase maybe is possible in the future. Some people said that if you increase the block space, you touch one piece of the puzzle that this is the revenue of the miners. Do you think it would play a role with that?
It will increase the revenue of the miners because they have more space to put more transactions in it. It doesn't change the difficulty of mining at all, whether you're doing one transaction or 5,000 transactions, and whether the block is 1 megabyte or if it's 4 or 6, it doesn't make any difference to the miners' profitability. But what does make a difference to miners is the fact that if they have, say, a 4 or 6 megabyte base block, then they can fit 8,000 transactions in it. And that means collecting more fees, even if the fees are lower per transaction. So you can get a benefit for miners without any extra cost. They can make more fees and a benefit for users because the users on average will be paying less per transaction.
Okay, thanks. So we'll go to the other question. M.A says for the Volume 1, Chapter 3, Privacy, Identity, Surveillance, and Money, says, Andreas, do you still take the same view as in this 2016 talk when you stated that spam transactions do not exist?
Yes, absolutely. When I say spam transactions do not exist, that doesn't mean that there aren't transactions that you or I or someone else can say, oh, yes, I think subjectively this is spam. But the problem with that definition is that spam is subjective. It's spam to you maybe, but it's not spam to the person who sent it. And so the real issue with characterizing transactions as spam is that you're trying to make a single perspective, a single subjective perspective, you're trying to make it into an absolute universal rule. That's censorship, basically. That would result, if you tried to enforce it, that would reduce freedom in the system. So what might be spam to you might be a very valuable and useful application to someone else. And part of the idea of an open decentralized system is that if you're willing to pay for the actual carrying costs of that transaction space that you're taking up on the blockchain, and then clearly the incentives exist, the economic validity exists in your transaction. Spam, as we understand it, is the ability to consume other people's resources without paying for them. That's the problem with spam email, for example. It doesn't cost anything to send email or to fill my mailbox, but it costs me to read it and to store it. But that's not how a blockchain works. On a blockchain, it does cost money to take up space, and the more space you take, the more you have to pay for it. So it's not free to send these things. And therefore, it's not spam. You've paid for access to a resource. You're not externalizing any of your carrying costs to others. And if you have a valid application that is worth it to you to pay the fee, then who am I to say that your application isn't valid? And again, as I said before, if you want to make distinctions between this is a legitimate use and this isn't a legitimate use, other than a philosophical argument, if you want to make those distinctions actually enforceable, then you have to change from a market-based determination of fees to a list of allowed applications determined by who? A committee, miners, developers. You essentially start putting gatekeepers in deciding what is and what isn't a legitimate application. So while people can have opinions about that, I don't see it as a good way to manage an actual network. And I don't want people deciding for me what is and isn't a legitimate application. I'd much rather say, if you can pay the fee, you can have the space. And what you do with it is your choice. And that allows the innovation to happen at the edges. It allows users to choose what they care about and how much they care about it, and not centralize those decisions in the hands of developers or miners. So no, there are no spam transactions.
Perfect, thanks. I have another question from Leo. This is a little longer. I ask you the three questions in one, and then you ask as you feel. He says, Leo says, do you still feel the same way about Ethereum when you say that Ethereum does not compete against Bitcoin? And also says, how do you reconcile the pre-sale and pre-mine with it now being proof of stake? And third, what do you think now about the DAO hack and the potential Gatecoin hack from 2016?
Yeah, so I still think that Ethereum doesn't compete against Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't compete against Ethereum. Ethereum would make a very sucky, robust monetary system, and Bitcoin would make a very sucky smart contract systems. They do not fulfill each other's jobs at all. And all attempts to do so on both sides have failed miserably. So I think they're very good systems for doing what they're trying to do and should stay in what they're trying to do best. Because any attempt to make Ethereum more like Bitcoin makes it worse at what it does. And the same the other way, any attempt to make Bitcoin do smart contracts makes it worse at being a good, sound monetary instrument. So I'm happy that they're not overlapping and not competing. They're not competing for anything other than developers. And if you want to be honest, if it's competition for developers, Ethereum is winning. And that's a conversation for another time as to why that's happening and how that happened. As for the pre-mine, I participated in the pre-sale. So here's a disclaimer for me. I participated in the Ethereum pre-sale and because I saw the potential and I thought it was a great opportunity to participate. So there's a difference between the pre-mine and the pre-sale, and a lot of people don't remember that difference. There was an amount allocated, about 20%, if I remember correctly, was allocated to the Ethereum Foundation directly. But other than that, it was a public pre-sale where anybody could go and buy Ethereum, pay Bitcoin, and buy it from the Ethereum Foundation. And that was pre-mined in the sense that the first Genesis block contained all of that Ethereum in the beginning. But that stake has gradually gotten diluted over time. If I remember correctly, it was about 26% per year was mined. So within 4 years, that initial pre-sale stake would have dropped to less than 25% of the total Ether available. So it was a minority stake. I don't think it makes any difference whether it's proof of stake or proof of work, because the simple truth of the matter is that in any system where you have an open distribution of assets like that, as happened with a pre-sale, for example, you will have social inequalities that pre-exist will be replicated again, meaning that those who have spare cash, the rich, can buy more of the resources. That happens in Bitcoin because not everyone can buy a mining machine or access to electricity, and not everyone could buy Bitcoin when it was worth $20 because they didn't have any spare cash to buy any. So economic inequality is a nature of human society, and that's not going to change based on one system or another. I think Bitcoin's early distribution was also unequal. It was unequal in other ways. Instead of it being going explicitly to a foundation with a specific charter and a group of members, it went to geeks who had the education, insight, equipment, mathematical knowledge, and programming knowledge to start mining in the first 3 years. Well, that's also unequal. It's just unequal on a different dimension. So I don't find those arguments very persuasive. And if you don't like Ethereum because of the pre-sale, no one's forcing you to like it. But I don't see that as something that condemns Ethereum or that was somehow not a legitimate way of capitalizing what was effectively a tech startup. And I find most arguments against that to be rather condescending and self-righteous. So I'm not really into that kind of criticism. If you want to criticize the technical decisions that are made, the business decisions in those early days. If you put money into the pre-sale or you were participating in Ethereum and doing 2 or 3 years of unpaid work and got sweat equity for it, I think that's good for you for taking that risk.
Perfect. Thanks for the answer. So I will have like 2 or 3 short questions, short answers, if you like.
Sure, let's do a lightning round.
Yes, Marco says, this question is about the anarchism you refer in many of your books and videos. Have you looked at classic anarchist works? If so, which ones would you recommend?
Oh, it's been a very long time since I read some of the classics, so I would not really be able to give you any guidance on anarchist political philosophy.
Okay, thanks. So next one, Francisco Javier says, it said that Bitcoin is the people's money, that it's made for the 6.5 billion people who does not belong to the first world. Don't you think that it's quite the opposite, that it's beginning to have a kind of elitist flavor?
No, not at all. Unlike any other monetary system, if you buy Bitcoin, you do not get access to the mechanisms that control Bitcoin. So owning Bitcoin does not allow you to change the rules of how Bitcoin operates. And that's something that we've never had before. In all other monetary systems, if you're rich enough, you then buy the politicians, and the politicians buy the central bank, and then the central bank does whatever you want, and the politicians pass whatever laws you want. And effectively, the entire political system becomes captured by those who have the money. That's not how Bitcoin works. So the fact that the person who has a few thousand Satoshis and the person who has a few thousand Bitcoin have exactly the same amount of control over the operation of the consensus rules, which is zero, means that this is a new and different system. It's not an elitist system at all. It's an elitist system in that the technical elite who actually understand how the technology works get to have an opinion that I pay attention to more because they actually know how the systems work. So in the very original sense of the word elite, which means someone who is the best at what they do, there is a technocratic elite, if you want, in Bitcoin, which is developers who we trust to not write shitty code and to write things that work. But even they don't have control over how the rules work. Everyone has to agree. So from that perspective, I think Bitcoin remains one of the most open available systems where the average person, for example, in Argentina, who owns a tiny bit of Bitcoin, has exactly the same amount of control over the consensus rules as, you know, Michael Saylor.
Well, thank you. That's a great answer. And the last one, this is for me. I already asked Julian this question the last week, and I think one of the hardest things to explain to someone is the physical nature of Bitcoin, right? And Satoshi talked about peer-to-peer electronic cash system, electronic, not virtual. So you can stop anything virtual, like virtual machines, virtual games. You can stop all these things, but electrons are for real. Yeah. So what would be your elevator pitch to explain to somebody, to someone, that Bitcoin is real, that it will exist?
So Bitcoin isn't just a computer program. It's also a computer network, and it's also an economy. And I think it's really important not to forget, especially the last part. So the computer program itself, if nobody's running it, it doesn't exist. But Bitcoin is run on tens of thousands of computers around the world. It's embedded in thousands and hundreds of thousands of chips and microcontrollers and embedded devices. It's on cube satellites flying around the planet, in fact. So the software is not just written, it also lives inside all of these computers that are running all around the world under the control of different people. And Bitcoin is also a giant community and a giant economy of millions upon millions of individuals who are using it for savings, who are using it for speculation, who are using it for payments, for investments, for whatever they might be using it. And these people are real people living real economic lives. You know, it's not just speculators trading on Wall Street. Very often when you go into the Bitcoin community and you start meeting people in your local Bitcoin community, you'll be shocked to find out how absolutely normal and average these people are. And I mean that in the best possible way. You'll meet the Bitcoin dentist, you'll meet the Bitcoin hairdresser, you'll meet the Bitcoin masseuse, you're going to meet the Bitcoin taxi driver. In fact, I've met a lot of those, by the way. Sometimes I'm surprised because they recognize me and I have no idea what's going on in the beginning. Millions of people around the world just living their lives who are using Bitcoin for some reason, for some instrument, and they give a life and a momentum to this invention that goes much beyond the original software. And so in their lives and through their lives, Bitcoin is everywhere around us. It's part of the internet. It's a very successful part of the internet. It's a very robust part of the internet, but it's also part of our society. And it's proven again and again to be incredibly resilient, probably one of the more robust digital systems that exist. It does not go down. And one of my favorite sayings that I think I coined back in 2016 was that no matter what, Bitcoin just continues. And day after day, hour after hour, tick tock, new block. It's as simple as that.
Wow, that's beautiful. So we could say that Bitcoin exists because we are Bitcoin, right?
We are Bitcoin. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I love that. I love that. So this was the last question. I think it's time to let Andreas go. Thank you very much, Andreas, for being here today. Did you enjoy it?
I very much did. I'm probably going to stick around in listen mode for a bit. I really, really do need to practice my Spanish, and there's probably no better way to do that than to hear you talking about Bitcoin, a subject that I'm actually interested in, and absorb as much as I can. And so I'll just stick around for a bit and listen in the background. And thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. Thank you. Sure. So we will open to the Spanish. Maybe someone has some questions in Spanish, and we'll stay with Julian. Thank you for having the author of the books with us and answering questions. First hand is a real luxury. It's likely that we'll be discussing volume 3 of the Internet of Money in the future. So I will write you again if you enjoyed today, maybe if you want to come back. And yeah, if you stick around, you will hear us. And thanks again, and see you soon.
Bueno, qué lindo tenerlo, Andreas, acá en una de estas charlas.
Buenísimo. Julián, vamos a continuar ahora en español. No sé, vamos a abrir el micro a ver si... Porque entiendo que a veces preguntar en inglés y tal, alguien le puede hacer un poco más de afrenta, pero si vamos a abrir el micro y si... ¿Alguien tiene alguna pregunta que hacer? Tenemos a Julián aquí también otra vez con nosotros, que le podéis tirar todas las pelotas que queráis, que estoy seguro que os las va a devolver todas. O sea, tenéis el micro abierto, no sé si alguien quiere preguntar algo.
Hola, Entropy. Hola, Juli. Solo quiero preguntar si esto quedó grabado, porque recién llego y me perdí todo.
Sí, quedó grabado.
Suben ahí a internet, hay una página que compartió Entropy, después te la comparto también si te interesa, Dani.
Genial, sí, gracias, gracias, sí lo escucho entero. Por lo menos llegué al saludo final.
Todo muy bien. Hubieron varias charlas que no se tocaron. Si tenés ganas, podemos compartir algunas de los insights que hay por ahí.
Sí, si quieres hacer tú algún highlight que te parezca a ti, también la gente puede, si no, preguntar o comentar qué le ha parecido la charla o algo del libro, simplemente.
Vale, si nadie quiere preguntar, hacemos alguna... algún debate sobre algunas de las otras charlas que yo tengo marcadas, dos que no pude hacer preguntas porque, bueno, no teníamos infinito tiempo con Andreas y entonces está bueno.
Dale.
Bueno, hay una de las charlas que estaba dentro de este libro que me parece que es de las mejores que tiene Andreas. Es la inmutabilidad de la prueba de trabajo, ¿sí? Creo que se llama la inmutabilidad a una escala planetaria. Si mal no recuerdo el video de YouTube, está Andreas y hay una pizarrona atrás, toda una pared azul, y él está hablando de cómo la prueba de trabajo que se realiza dentro de la red de Bitcoin es lo que le garantiza la inmutabilidad y el hecho de que Bitcoin no pueda cambiar. El hecho de que exista este mecanismo de consenso que nos entrelaza las leyes de la naturaleza, que es el doble gasto de energía, y que por ende nadie va a poder gastar la energía y tratar de propagar un bloque falso. O sea, lo pueden intentar hacer, pero quedan enclavados contra la naturaleza, teniendo que pagar la energía y no quedándose con los bitcoins de la red de Bitcoin, que eso es la genialidad que hace Satoshi, ¿no? El entrelazar un bien escaso dentro de la naturaleza que ninguna otra de los mecanismos de consenso por ahora lo ha logrado replicar. Si uno mira el Proof of Stake, tiene sus problemas con los long range attacks o con el simple hecho de que alguien te puede crear varias versiones de la historia de la blockchain y son indistinguibles una de la otra. Y el hecho de que la prueba de trabajo sea una propiedad de la naturaleza tan preciosa, por decirlo así, alguien te da el nonce, vos lo combinás con el resto de los parámetros del bloque y decís, esto cumple las pruebas de trabajo, es increíble. Y no solamente que es esta prueba de trabajo, sino que es algo acumulativo. Y acumulativo quiere decir que capaz que hoy un microchip que nosotros tenemos y que esté hasheando era todo lo que había de la prueba de trabajo durante los primeros 2 años de la red de Bitcoin. O sea, hoy las computadoras que nosotros tenemos son, voy a decir un número aleatorio, cientos de miles de veces más rápidas que las computadoras que estaban inicialmente operando en esta prueba de trabajo. Y todo ese trabajo ha sido acumulado de forma de que si vos querés arrancar de la historia de Bitcoin, podrías reescribir rápidamente los primeros años de la red de Bitcoin, pero a medida que vos vas viendo o que vas llegando hasta las épocas más nuevas de la blockchain, eso hace que no lo puedas ir reescribiendo, ¿sí? a estas velocidades. Y que tal vez, ¿sí? Hay algo que no sé si es que queda escondido, pero creo que estaba en una de las charlas de RGB, si mal no recuerdo, ¿sí? Que RGB, no importa, del doctor que tiene esa implementación de client-side validation, que decía que el único uso que nosotros tenemos para una blockchain, que es la blockchain, en general la gente piensa que es el entrelazamiento de los bloques, ¿sí? Y con eso uno transmite las transacciones, pero el doctor en ese caso decía que el único caso de uso de la blockchain es para, ¿verdad?, transmitir la prueba de trabajo. O sea, vos al estar entrelazando los bloques, lo que estás transmitiendo es el último estado de la red de sincronismo y estás transmitiendo la última prueba de trabajo que se realizó completamente. Lo que hace el paralelismo que hace Andreas en esa charla es compararla con grandes construcciones que han llevado, voy a decir décadas, pero probablemente sea siglos, que son tal vez las pirámides de Egipto o la Gran Muralla China. El hecho de uno tener que estar construyendo, en este caso Bitcoin ha estado construyéndose durante 15 años, no es tanto en tiempo histórico y en fenómenos monetarios, pero el hecho de que lo siga haciendo y que bloque a bloque, como dijo Andrea hace un rato, tic a tic, se sigan construyendo los bloques y que estemos a unos 45 días del bloque 840.000, ¿viste? Ya es significativo. Quiere decir que el sistema ha estado funcionando bloque a bloque durante 15 años o 16 años, cuando llegue la fecha, de forma de cómo estuvo diseñado directamente.
Ahora mismo, estoy en España, son ya las 11 de la noche, estaba escuchándote atentamente, me estaba costando seguirte, era de lo que estabas explicando, y cuando recurriste a las pirámides de Egipto, me vino ya a la mente, digamos que organicé todo lo previo, digo, vale, ya sé perfectamente de qué me está hablando, con algo, y digamos que esa parte de Andreas es la que a mí me tiene enamorado. Entonces, ¿cómo es capaz de coger conceptos complejos, explicártelo desde un punto de vista complejo y siempre buscar ese ejemplo tan sencillo que hasta alguien como yo, que no tiene unos conocimientos técnicos muy básicos, puede llegar a entenderlos? Y es que lo que acabas escuchándote ahora mismo me vino eso. Llegó el momento en el que cuando hablaste de las pirámides de Egipto, del trabajo que hay, de cómo las civilizaciones dan esa manifestación del trabajo acumulado haciendo eso, y vamos, solo poner esa puntilla de que realmente para mí de estos libros esas partes es lo mejor. Como después Andreas, con cuatro palabras, con una historia, te explica todo lo que tú llevas ahora exponiendo perfectamente en 5 minutos. Solo decir eso, porque me gustó mucho tu intervención de ahora.
Andreas es un especialista en bajar a tierra conceptos muy, muy difíciles y entrelazarlos con una buena metáfora. El otro que estuvimos hablando hoy, que es el león versus el tiburón, que también es magnífica la charla en el sentido de que agarra conceptos muy, muy grandes de cómo están evolucionando estos sistemas y con una metáfora la clava en el ángulo, por decirlo de una forma muy argentina, diciendo el que no sepa nada de desarrollo de sistemas, el que no sepa nada de ingeniería o de estos conceptos, con entender la metáfora le alcanza para entender el concepto, y en eso lo arma muy bien a lo largo de toda la serie de Internet of Money. Arma estos conceptos muy sencillos y son muy buenos, la verdad que sí.
Por eso de hecho, sí, de hecho, el elevator pitch final, yo creo que eso hay que transcribirlo ya y enmarcarlo, porque quedó también explicado la realidad de Bitcoin en los 2 minutos del elevator pitch.
Claro, viste, la semana pasada yo me trabé hablando de bits ordenados en decenas de computadoras y él dijo, y Bitcoin es todas las personas que vos vas conociendo alrededor de Bitcoin también, ¿no? Y te das cuenta, y eso es real, porque son personas reales. Y conoces su historia, conoces un taxista, conoces personas que adaptaron esto, que no son el típico nerd, sino que es una persona más que ahorra en Bitcoin o que invierte en Bitcoin, por decirlo, llamarlo de alguna manera, y lo hace genialmente también.
Muchas gracias por las preguntas de esta noche, por toda la charla, la he disfrutado, os saludo también desde Madeira. A mí creo que el momento donde entendí la profundidad de la prueba de trabajo fue cuando preparamos aquel pod de Pou contra POS, y en el que reflexioné sobre lo que muchas veces se pone sobre la mesa de qué pasaría si hubiera una tormenta solar y de golpe se cayera internet y se tuviera que parar todo, la red eléctrica y demás, ¿no? Y ahí dije, entendí que la prueba de trabajo es infalseable. O sea, la prueba de trabajo es trabajo. Y lo que pasaría, o sea, poniéndome en la situación, es que la red rearrancaría poco a poco cuando las diferentes zonas fueran recuperando electricidad, y entonces tú empezarías a recibir bloques de los que no tenías conciencia y que a lo mejor se han minado en Indonesia, en China. Pero la gracia de Bitcoin es que no tendrías que creerte que ha habido unos mineros que han seguido trabajando y que han encontrado ese bloque. Es que lo puedes verificar. Es que la prueba de trabajo no se puede falsificar. Es que vas a tener una cantidad de ceros delante en el hash y que ese hash va a ser el hash de una cantidad de transacciones que estaban pendientes de confirmar y que encajan con la historia previa que tú tenías en Bitcoin. Eso en Proof of Stake no lo tienes. En Proof of Stake, si pasara algo así, tendrían un problemita. Tendrían un problemita de saber cuál es la verdad. En Bitcoin eso no hace falta. Es sencillo, es fácil. Se sabe, ves los bloques, cómo se han ordenado, ves qué bloques han llegado antes, y aunque hayan llegado antes, sobre cuáles se ha construido, y la prueba de trabajo no se puede falsificar. O has quemado energía, o has hecho el trabajo, o no se puede falsificar.
Eso es muy real. Y yo creo que esa, a medida que fueron pasando los años, los dos criptosistemas más populares se fueron cada vez divergiendo más, no solamente entre sus use cases, sino también en su mecanismo de consenso, en cómo uno funciona con cuentas y cómo otro funciona con lo, como le dicen ustedes, los huchos ahí en España o UTXOs. Y bueno, la prueba de trabajo versus la prueba de participación es una de esas divergencias más. Y particularmente por ser una persona física y eléctrico, me gusta más la prueba de trabajo. Es cierto que también bootstrapear un sistema solamente con protección económica, por llamarlo de alguna manera, la prueba de participación, es mucho más sencillo. Uno crea y mintea las monedas, y cuando esas van adquiriendo valor económico, uno de alguna forma defiende al sistema con un poderío económico. Pero como lo hablábamos la semana pasada, la capa física de defensa de los sistemas no se puede vulnerar. La capa física es la capa física, y eso básicamente es la última defensa.
Bueno, vamos a... Si no hay más preguntas, quiero más o menos que no. Son las 11 y pico ya. Tenemos... tengo otra sorpresa para ti también, Julián. bueno, qué noche, ¿eh? Qué noche. Para despedirnos aún nos falta un notición. Y es que ya os habíamos dicho estos días por el chat que teníamos una primicia. Hoy hemos tenido a Andreas, hemos tenido a Julián, que aún está aquí con nosotros. Y como no hay dos sin tres, esta noche, señor Alfred Mancera, estás por ahí. Buenas noches.
Hola, buenas noches.
¿Qué tal? ¿Qué te ha parecido la charla?
Pues bastante guapa. Lamento no enterarme de todo porque sigo siendo un poco penoso en el listening en inglés, pero todo lo que me he enterado me ha encantado. Y como siempre, la labor de Julián, ¿no? Dirigiendo y también condensando. Y como buen argentino tiene correa para rato. Como buen argentino técnico. Y nada, me lo paso muy bien. La verdad que tenéis montado una comunidad que da gusto estar y, bueno, pues aquí estamos para presentar lo que se viene, ¿no?
Que se viene. Cuéntanos qué es Cryptoria.
Bueno, pues Cryptoria es el libro que estoy preparando que, como lo podía hacer de otra manera, cuando creaste Prometea, pues vi claro que era la forma de lanzarlo, la forma de distribuirlo, las personas con las que quería trabajar para no hacerlo de manera independiente, y también era un poquito reacio a trabajar con editoriales más grandes o hacerle la propuesta, otra cosa que ya quisieran ellos publicar la idea que yo tuviese, ¿no? Y estaba claro que con Prometea se alineaban bueno, todos los factores en ese sentido y bueno, pues al final comparto la sinopsis que tenemos preparada. Y creo que con esto la gente se podrá hacer una idea. Ya también me conocen un poco los temas que me gusta divulgar, así que es un poquito una condensación de la información que voy dando todos estos años atrás. Y Cryptoria va a ser eso, un relato de una selección de hitos acontecidos en la historia de la ingeniería y también de la lucha por la soberanía digital, desde los tiempos de Alan Turing hasta la invención de Bitcoin. Así que os voy a proponer un paseo a través de personas, eventos, organizaciones e inventos del siglo XX que han influenciado en el origen de la informática y, por supuesto, en la aplicación de criptografía fuerte, la seguridad, la privacidad y el dinero digital del ciberespacio. Así que nada, la idea es ampliar cultura y el conocimiento de todos los usuarios de Bitcoin. Y bueno, si puede ser un puente que conecte con el público general a este universo, pues... encantado.
Tremendo. Yo es que soy eso y se me estaba poniendo la piel de gallina, ¿eh? He tenido que cogerme la silla así para no caerme para atrás. qué ganas de tenerlo, leerlo. Estad atentos. Pronto vamos a dar más noticias. Va a ser un libro... Voy a compartir una reflexión que no es mía, es del gran Miguel Vidal. Que le dije, mira, esto te lo voy a picar. Porque hablando así en privado, también comentando de temas del libro, dijo Miguel, dijo, este libro es muy importante porque son los libros que crean usuarios conscientes. Y me pareció bellísimo esto. Porque creo que será un libro para entender de verdad lo que tenemos entre manos, que esto no es una cosa que haya salido ahora, sino es de décadas de las mejores mentes trabajando en esto. Y no sé, es un libro muy necesario que aborda mucho valor. O sea que gracias, Alfred.
Gracias a ti. Gracias a ti por estar en proyectos como este. Sobre todo por quererme bien intelectualmente hablando y darme la oportunidad y también el soporte para que vaya desarrollando también a mi ritmo, obviamente con unos plazos y tal, pero que vaya trabajando respetando mi enfoque. Entonces yo agradezco eso. Y luego también, a lo mejor es una temática muy de nicho, voy a intentar, de hecho estoy intentando que la redacción sea pues fácilmente comprensible para todo el mundo, incluso cuando trate alguna cuestión técnica, que no va a ser un libro técnico, sino como digo, bueno, es un recorrido cultural, histórico y que sirva de iniciación, ¿no?, a la tecnología. Y también ponga en valor algo relacionado con lo que estabais hablando, la prueba de trabajo, ¿no? Hay una prueba de trabajo intelectual muy concreta donde hay gente que se ha jugado muchas cosas para que nosotros hoy podamos disfrutar de estas implementaciones, ¿no?, de todos estos inventos que han ido ellos desarrollando. Y bueno, el más evidente que nos une es Bitcoin. Pero claro, para llegar aquí hay, como digo, una prueba de trabajo que está bien que no se pierda. Hay muchísimas entidades, bueno, muchísimas, hay unas pocas de entidades, suficientes entidades que guardan la información y también, digamos, la tradición escrita de toda esta historia de la criptografía orientada para, bueno, preservar la soberanía digital. Y bueno, pues yo voy a intentar mantenerlo. Como ya sabéis, lo he hecho de forma oral durante bastante tiempo y ahora me gustaría dejarlo escrito para que prevalezca y sea también un libro atemporal que se pueda consultar en cualquier momento y también vaya acompañado de un buen dossier de fuentes para que todo el que quiera profundizar pues pueda tener, digamos, una senda clara por dónde ir.
Genial. Esperando estaremos. Estad atentos. Queríamos hoy hacer un pequeño aquí avance. Vamos a dar más noticias en las próximas semanas, pero queríamos, ya que estamos hoy aquí en familia, en el club de lectura, y viniendo Andrea, estando Julián, que Julián, de hecho, Julián y Alfred, os conocéis de... ¿Os visteis en Argentina, no? La última BitCon, ¿no?
Sí, nos desvirtualizamos en Argentina. Fue uno de los regalos de 2023, la verdad. Y bueno, pues encantado de que sea él un poco el maestro de ceremonias hoy y que esté aquí. Y bueno, aunque no sé si tiene mucho tiempo, pero bueno, hay una anécdota. O sea, Julián, conocerte fue bastante, bueno, fue bastante emocionante. Pero hubo un momento, me acuerdo, el primer día del evento, que había una celebración, una fiesta, ¿no? Y había un concierto de una banda tributo a Pink Floyd. Iba Larry Page, saxofonista de Pink Floyd, que tocó con ellos. Y de pronto había otros side events, ¿no?, por ahí. Y la gente, conocía muchísima gente, pero se empezó a quitar de en medio todo el mundo. Y me quedé en el main stage rodeado de peña que no conocía. De pronto estaba buscando así gente, ¿no?, que conociese. Había dos personas que yo había invitado que estaban conmigo. Argentina, y de pronto, entre todas las caras, veo el perfil de Julián ahí y con la sonrisa eterna esa y creo que era bastante consciente de lo que iba a pasar allí. Y bueno, pues eso, disfrutamos de casi 2 horas de directo de música, que fue la hostia. Y ese momento, para mí, también está grabado ahí en la retina, como NFT del corazón. Y nada, quería compartirlo también de forma pública.
Gracias, Alfred, gracias. La verdad que un tremendo show ese de The End, que es la banda tributo acá de Argentina de Pink Floyd, que son increíbles. Yo me acuerdo ahí que Page le dice, estaba hablando en el micrófono y comenta, no los conozco a estos pibes, no sé qué tal tocan. Y por dentro yo decía, quédate tranquilo que esta gente la rompe al lado tuyo. Y nos maravillaron con 2 horas de un recitalazo, la verdad. Fue increíble.
Sí, de loco. O sea, estaba previsto para media hora, 40 minutos, y estuvimos 2 horas ahí. Aquí sí viene bien la Web3 y la blockchain, ¿eh? Porque hubo una chica que me regaló una camiseta de Web3, blockchain y tal, y cuando terminó el concierto tenía mi camiseta empapada y dije, Dios, Me voy a poner malísimo. Y me acordé, digo, hostia, hay una chica que me regaló una camiseta de Web3, blockchain, no sé qué. Esta me va a venir bien para eso. Me vino cojonudo la blockchain. Ahí estará.
Bueno, chicos, qué tarde, más maja. Aquí es en vivo con unas birras nos echábamos la tarde. Gracias, Julián, por estar aquí estas dos sesiones. Hemos aprendido un montón. Si en algún futuro quieres volver a otra edición, estás invitado. Totalmente.
Por supuesto. Ya, si querés, me comprometo a cuando pasen un par de... Justo ahora tengo un mes complicado que estoy de mudanza, pero después hacemos Internet of Money Volume 3.
Buenísimo, buenísimo. Ahí estaremos. Y Afre, muchas gracias también por pasar por aquí, por anunciarlo. Y nada, que la gente que sepa que pronto van a saber más cositas. Y nada, nos despedimos aquí. Han sido dos sesiones intensas y nos vemos en dos semanas con Los Mandible y con Alberto Mera. Así que nada, que tengáis buena noche y nos vemos en 15 días. Chao.